dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is my great privilege to have with us a man who I think is playing an outsized role in helping, well, millions of us understand the nature of that war, specifically as it relates to what I think is best described as Sharia supremacism. He is Robert Spencer. He is always a welcome guest here, especially as we note and mourn the latest incident of an attack by these Sharia supremacists, it appears, in Manchester in the United Kingdom. Robert Spencer, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here always, Frank.
I'd like to ask you about this attack. Robert, as we speak, of course, it's still early on in the investigation of it. Details are trickling out beyond the loss of life in this concert involving lots of young people, including some children, several of whom, it appears now, were among the casualties, many others wounded, evidently. Give us your read on both the immediate instance and, more broadly, what it tells us about what we're up against.
Well, this was yet another jihad martyrdom suicide bombing, and there seems to have been a network behind it, as the UK authorities have already arrested two young Muslims in connection with the bombing, and, of course, the bomber himself was killed, as it was a suicide attack. And they are out in force today searching for more people who may have been involved in this. So what we have is yet another result of the policies that the UK and Western governments have been pursuing for so many years. Unrestricted immigration from jihadi hotspots combined with an unwillingness to compel the new immigrants to obey the laws of the land and rather allowing them to set up Sharia enclaves where hatred of the infidel and the necessity to commit violence against him is taught. And so now we see once again, this is what happens when you do this, and it's going to keep happening until these policies are reversed.
Yeah. Manchester in Britain is said to be one of those places. I think enclave doesn't do justice to it. I think the majority of the population now may be Muslim, not all of whom, I hope, are aligned with Sharia supremacism, but unfortunately, it seems, as is often the case in these circumstances, many, many are. Robert, let me ask you, as you look at this and you've very clinically described what seems to be at work here, talk a little bit about the speech that the president made in Riyadh over the weekend and his characterization of what we're dealing with as a war between good and evil, with the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks and many others in the Muslim world ostensibly on the side of good. Is that how you see it?
Well, you know, I think the president had a very, very difficult road to navigate in that speech. He was speaking, of course, to some of the world's chief sponsors of jihad terrorism, and yet ostensibly they condemn it. And so I think that what he did was really a rather remarkable feat of challenging them to back up their words with action and stating the truth, but not in a way that would be so openly antagonistic to them. He invited them to a better path. Now, the question will be whether he follows through when they don't comply, as they certainly will not. In other words, you have the Saudis, and they're saying the king had just said, as a matter of fact, that Islam is a religion of peace and has nothing to do with terrorism and so on. And so he says, drive them out of your places of worship, which shows that he knows where this is coming from. He knows where these people are gathering, where they're being indoctrinated, and he's challenging them to do something realistic about it and back up their words with deeds when they condemn these things. It was really, I think, a remarkably skillful speech. Of course, once again, he's not being given credit for that.
Yeah. But Robert, let me just ask you, because you are deeply knowledgeable. When they say Islam is a religion of peace, when they say that they denounce terrorism, when they say there is no coercion in religion and the like, what should we understand about the terms they're using and how they mean them that enables them to say it without, well, falling completely afoul of the truth as they see it?
They're saying it with perfect sincerity, as a matter of fact, because they have different understandings of what all these words mean. And this is something that takes in non-Muslims who are uninformed so easily. They hear about justice, that Muslims are working for justice, for peace, and they think that they have this exactly the same frame of reference that we do when we speak about justice and peace. When in reality, they're talking about terrorism, countering terrorism, they think of the United States and Israel as the terrorist states, and not what the jihad terrorists are doing as terrorism necessarily at all. And justice is the imposition of Sharia, which institutionalizes the inequality of women with men, institutionalizes discrimination against non-Muslims, gays, so many others. And so the unwitting Westerner who hears these things is very easily fooled. And many of our leaders, including presidents, have been taken in by this kind of thing. It's far past time for a much more informed response. And we can only hope that when the president speaks about Islamic extremism, that he's going to follow through on that and allow for law enforcement and intelligence agencies to study the motivating ideology behind all this, which they've been forbidden to do under the Obama administration since 2011.
I pray you're right. And I fear, Robert, that one of the upshots of being side by side with the Saudis and other enablers of this jihadism may be more willful blindness. We'll see. We'll urge him, as I know you will, at jihadwatch.org to break with all of that. Let me ask you quickly about two other things, Robert. The Muslim Brotherhood as an engine in this Islamic extremism, should they be designated as a terrorist organization in this country as well as elsewhere?
Yes, there's no doubt whatsoever about it. As a matter of fact, Frank, I recently came across an article arguing that they should not be because they go about their business in nonviolent ways in general. Now, that's not always true. They've been responsible for a terrible reign of terror against the Christians in Egypt ever since they were toppled from power. They've scapegoated the Christians there and brutalized and victimized them with tremendous violence. Now, in that being said, the main thing that we have to keep in mind is that even when they work in nonviolent means, they are working for the same goal exactly as the terrorists, and that is the imposition of Sharia wherever it can be imposed. And so this has to be recognized, that we have to stop thinking about how they're going about doing what they're doing and focus on what they are trying to accomplish. And we do not want to live in a Sharia state here, so that is something that has to be addressed in a realistic way.
Amen. Robert, lastly, you were, as I understand it, poisoned in Iceland recently. Tell us what happened and how you were faring.
I spoke in Iceland last week. It was a very successful event. And right after it, we went to a local restaurant, the organizers, my security team, and the other speaker. And I was greeted by name by a young man, an Icelandic man, who said he was a big fan and shook my hand. And it seems that he slipped some poison in my drink when he did this, because I not long after that became very, very severely ill and had all the symptoms of a drug overdose. And the drugs were indeed found in my system. And so it seems that this is the outcome. You know, Frank, you and I have been subjected to this relentless battering rhetoric from the left for years, that we are racist, bigoted Islamophobes for daring to oppose jihad terrorism and Sharia supremacism. And this is the outcome, that leftists now think that we are Hitler incarnate, that we are evil, and that they're justified and righteous if they do violence to us. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this.
Well, I pray you're wrong, but I'm very grateful that you have survived this particular attack. And thank you for your service. You are, of course, a serious and, I think, entirely accurate characterizer of what we're facing. far from these slanderous allegations against you, my friend. And it's always appreciated when you visit with us and help clarify what indeed we confront. Keep it up, my friend, at jihadwatch.org and on your other platforms, Front Page Magazine and at PJ. Bless you. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll talk with Claudia Rosette. We'll get her take on the latest in Iran, North Korea, and the UN right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claudia Rosette, one of the great investigative reporters of our time, having served most especially at the Wall Street Journal in a number of capacities, including foreign assignments. She is these days a columnist for PJ Media and also for Forbes.com, an extraordinary resource for us on a whole host of matters, and we're always delighted to have her with us. Claudia, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, let's start with one of the major reasons for the president's trip to Saudi Arabia and his conclave there, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. And clearly he's interested in marshaling opposition to what it's doing now and what it may do in the future. Give us a flavor, particularly, Claudia, after this recent election, such as it was in Iran, of where you think things stand and where we are likely to go from here.
Well, the Iranians certainly aren't happy that President Trump has paid so much attention to the Saudis. And this is what he was doing there was in part trying to right some balance in the region where Iran, on President Obama's watch, was just lavished with all sorts of very substantial favors from the U.S. The rotten Iran nuclear deal, those stacks of cash on pallets delivered in early last year, and basically this sort of great allowed to sort of follow its wishes in the Middle East. The question, though, is where does this actually go? And with Iran, we still have the problem that there's this terrible nuclear deal in place, which basically guarantees them both, allows them a way to nuclear weapons. If they stick with the deal, they arrive at a point where they can very easily just proceed to make the bomb. Or my own view is they probably will cheat much sooner because that is rewarding too.
Claudia, you were just making the point that either way, as a result of the practice of the Obama administration, which was to give great attention to the Iranians at the expense of the Sunnis in the Middle East, we are likely to see an Iranian nuclear weapon in the not-too-distant future, perhaps the relatively near future at that. How does that change the complexion of the problem that we're currently facing from the Iranians, aside from obviously making it worse?
Well, it not only makes it dramatically worse, it means that I think some of this is already in motion. Other people want nuclear weapons. Actually, part of the I think this connects to a great many things, Frank. I think that I don't have proof for you, but I ask the question very strongly. Is it sheer coincidence that the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal, where we were told by the Obama administration, okay, now they're not going to be pursuing the nuclear bomb, dovetails so perfectly, so neatly with the increased activity by North Korea, which is a longtime arms dealer to the Iranians, has worked with them on developing ballistic missiles, for which the real purpose is what? To carry nuclear weapons, right? And is advancing, apparently at some speed, on the path of developing nuclear missiles. Well, you've got a set of things in play there, where there's now an incentive for a number of other countries to get nuclear weapons. You still have that problem. It has not been solved. And the Saudis, you've sent, I think, a good message to the world, to the Middle East, in the sense that you're not going to dramatically favor the Iranians, world leading state sponsor of terror, in the Middle East, that, you know, buddying up to the Saudis sends the message, you're not going to be close friends with the Iranians. On the other hand, the Saudis themselves pose plenty of problems still. You know, that is where a lot of the impetus that has translated into the jihadi attacks, including September 11th, has come from. And it, will that really end? So we're, it's a very complicated game here, and we're very far from seeing any real answer. I think I was deeply relieved that President Trump did not go to Tehran and present an arms deal to the Iranians. But and I think there were good signs here, Frank. You know, I was pleased to see that the Saudi king shook the hand of the first lady. That was a good thing for everybody to see.
And I think it's very important, Claudia, to make this point of the nexus between Iran and North Korea. You've been, of course, following very diligently what's going on in the North at the moment. Claudia, as you say, there's been this partnership between the Iranians and the North Koreans on both their nuclear weapons activities and their ballistic missile programs. The ballistic missile programs are continuing apace in both countries, in North Korea most especially.
Well, Frank, we're seeing, I want to be careful there. We know that there is collaboration on missiles. What we have never had any official confirmation of from our own government, there's been plenty in the press, but I'd like to see it officially confirmed, if in fact it's the case, and I would wager that it is, that they are also, that North Korea and Iran have also been working together on nuclear weapons. This was part of the murk under President Obama. There was never a confirmation, never a clear denial either.
Yeah.
And it's something
I think
President
we've
Trump
had,
should let us know.
We've had extensive.
One way or the other.
Well, I agree with that. And Claudia, I think your cautionary note is probably in order. But on the other hand, I think we've had lots of reporting of Iranian experts at the North Korean nuclear tests, and it at the very least creates the clear implication that they're doing in the nuclear program what they're doing for sure in the ballistic missile program. But let me just make the larger point, Claudia, and that is that we're looking at a North Korean threat that is metastasizing rapidly and can only be seen, I think, by the Iranians as a further encouragement to complete their own nuclear ambitions, that our dealing with North Korea is unmistakably different now that it is a nuclear weapon state. I think the Iranians are determined to make sure that we have to treat them differently as well. There is evidence that someone has now conducted a very aggressive and apparently well-informed hacking attack against a UN expert panel that is supposed to be monitoring the efforts to violate sanctions by the North Koreans. You know better than just about anybody what the UN is about. You also have a deep knowledge of what the North Koreans are about. Do you suspect that it would be the North Koreans engaged in this kind of attack? What do you think the results of it will be?
Could be the Iranians, could be friends of the North Koreans, could be the Russians for that matter, or the Chinese, or the North Koreans themselves. What stands out to me is the panel of experts on North Korea sanctions is one of the best things at a United Nations where a lot of things work very badly or counter to the interests of anything in the free world. And they've actually been turning out good reports, Frank. This is against all odds. A group that has actually been documenting in some more depth than I had hoped for the incredible web of proliferation connections used by North Korea, and that this group should be hacked is both alarming because they have sources that point them to things where I would hope not to see those sources compromised, destroyed, attacked. You know, the North Koreans assassinate people, as you might recall from the VX nerve agent scene in Kuala Lumpur with Kim Jong-un's brother.
Among others. Yeah. Claudia Rosette, thank you so much for your time today, as always, and for your good work at PJ and also at Forbes.com and at the Independent Women's Forum. Come back to us again very soon, if you would.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Itamar Marcus, a man that we've turned to with some regularity for insights into, well, the ground truth with respect to the prospects for peace between the Palestinians and Israel. This is much in the news, of course, at the moment, as President Trump has been in Palestinian-controlled areas on the West Bank, notably in Bethlehem. He has met with apparently the president for life of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. We wanted to do a little bit of a sanity check with Itamar Marcus of Palestinian Media Watch, who has been chronicling very closely and I think with great effect the truth, the reality about what the Palestinians are up to at the moment. And it's a great pleasure to have him with us. Itamar, thank you for taking a few minutes for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So the president has met with Abbas. He met with him before, of course, in the White House recently. While he was in the White House, he told the president that the Palestinians are teaching their children about peace, encouraging them to be peaceable. I have the feeling this falls into the category of something I talked about earlier in the program with Robert Spencer about the different meanings for the sort of Islamists like Abbas and for the rest of us when they use terms like peace. Would you tease that out for us and again, do a truth check on that?
Yes. Well, first of all, they absolutely do not promote peace. The Palestinian Authority and its schools and its official television, you know, is teaching its children. He specifically focused on teaching his children a culture of peace, he said. They teach their children that the Jews are monkeys and pigs, etc. And then they glorify the killers of Israelis, the killers of Israeli civilians, including in the last few weeks, the Palestinian Authority, since the meeting with Donald Trump. They've named squares, two squares after terrorist murderers, the Palestinian Authority has. So this constant glorifying of murders is the antithesis of teaching and promoting peace. And it's done not just at squares, it's done in children's sporting events. We've had soccer tournaments named for terrorists. There was a soccer tournament last year named for a 13-year-old Palestinian boy who stabbed and almost murdered an Israeli 13-year-old boy. And this was in the school system. So there's no promotion of peace. Now, you talked about the different meaning of words, and I'll tell you something fascinating. Last year, when the Palestinian Authority was involved in, when Palestinians were involved in this terror wave where they were stabbing and shootings and car rammings of Israelis almost daily for a period of months, Mahmoud Abbas went on television and he said that they're in favor, they're against terror, he said. We're against terror. Of course, we're against terror. We want peace. And then he said, but what's happening is what we called for. This is a peaceful uprising. He called the murder of Israelis through using knives and car rammings and some guns as a peaceful uprising. And he said, this is what we called for. So for them and for Palestinian Authority, fighting Israelis who they see as the enemy is therefore within the context of peace. And this is the absurdity. So he could actually tell Donald Trump, we're promoting peace, because for him, peace means any kind of actions against Israel.
This is, I guess, the crux of the matter. As we look to the possibilities of a new round of negotiations, which the president is clearly determined to promote, does the Israeli government have in Abbas a man with whom it can safely do business based upon what you've just said, Itamar Marcus? It sounds from what you've indicated is bad faith at best, and at worst it is going to be yet another snare and delusion.
Well, there are two possibilities, and in either way, there's no way that Israel can make a deal with Abbas at this point in history. Either Abbas is lying to his own people for many years, and then he's saying the truth that he wants peace, or he's really continuing the same deception that Yasser Arafat did for many years, and that any Israeli withdrawal from any territory that it needs, both for historical reasons and security reasons, will then become a new launching ground for terror against Israel. So that's the, and that might be his intention. But even worse, even if it's not his intention, even if Abbas has made a 180-degree turn in the last few weeks and he now really wants peace with Israel, he has been poisoning the minds of Palestinian people for so many years, and the Palestinian children for so many years, that there's no way that the people themselves would say, okay, now that we're close enough to Tel Aviv that we can hit them with simple bombs, let's start bombing Tel Aviv, let's start bombing the airport. In other words, the people would never keep it. They would never preserve a peace treaty that he would sign today.
So as you look at the state of play on the ground at the moment, Itamar, is it fair to say that there's been no change in the Palestinian view of Israel, that it remains absolutely opposed to the existence of the state of Israel and is inculcating in its children an expectation that Israel will be destroyed, which inevitably translates into a condition that is not, shall we say, conducive to peace, but that the outside pressure on Israel to persist in trying to make peace is fundamentally intensifying the expectations of its enemies that they will ultimately triumph over Israel. I mean, is there any other way that this dynamic can work out as you see it?
Let me just tell you a quote from a Palestinian children's program on official Palestinian TV. And this is what I'm convinced, and polls have shown this as well, that Palestinian youth today are convinced of. There was a puppet, and they had a picture of a puppet in Tel Aviv. And then the moderator says, oh, I'm so glad you had fun in Jaffa, which they stole and now call Tel Aviv. But don't worry, Jaffa and Haifa and Akko and all the cities occupied by Israel in 1948 will return to us someday. Most important children's program called Best Home on Palestinian TV. And that's how Palestinian children are being brought up, that every part of Israel is an occupation and will certainly return to them someday. A poll a few years ago Palestinians were asked if they recognize Israel's right to exist. And people over 50% recognized Israel's right to exist. And in the youngest category that they questioned, age 18 to 25, only 8% recognized Israel's right to exist. 92% said Israel had no right to exist. So the Palestinian education has totally destroyed any sense of recognition of Israel. The older people who remember Israel before Oslo, those are the ones who recognized Israel. But the younger people who've been brainwashed and indoctrinated by the Palestinian Authority, there is no recognition of Israel. And these are the people that are going to continue fighting against Israel, even if a peace treaty is agreed upon now and there'll be some kind of Israeli withdrawal. Those children who don't think Israel has a right to exist, and they hate Israel, and they hate Jews because that's the way they've been trained by their leaders, they will continue the battle and the terror and the fight, and that Israel will be doing this from very, very impossible borders.
Yeah. Itamar, lastly, you and Palestinian Media Watch do an extraordinarily important job of monitoring the media of the Palestinian Authority. Is there any indication on that the Palestinians have been moved by what they heard from President Trump, either in Riyadh or in the course of his travels in Israel and on the West Bank, to a different view of Israel, of a willingness to eschew violence and come to terms?
No, there's been no indication at all. There's a lot of skepticism that they've been expressing about Trump. And there's certainly, and whenever they talk about optimism, it's only because they feel that maybe Trump will put pressure on Israel. There is never a word on their side about a compromise or about seeing Israel differently, Israel's still the evil country, and fighting Israel is still heroic. And if Trump can put pressure on Israel, then they'll support Trump.
Itamar Marcus, thank you so much for taking a few minutes for an up-to-the-minute analysis of what is happening in the Middle East and as a result of the president's visit. We'll stay in touch with you and appreciate so much, again, the work you do at Palestinian Media Watch. Check it out at palwatch.org. Next up, we'll talk to Kevin Freeman. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow, Kevin Freeman. He is a man of many parts, the founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com, a best-selling author two times over, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, was his first book. His second, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin is also soon to be the star of stage and screen as the host of a new television program on the Blaze Network called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We're always pleased to have him with us to talk about economic warfare, among other things. Kevin, glad to have you back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Well, one of the upshots of the president's travels in Saudi Arabia, of course, was the announcement that in addition to a major weapons sale to the Saudis, there's going to be a very substantial amount of Saudi funding coming into the United States in the form of investment in infrastructure. Kevin, you and I have talked about this in the past, specifically with respect to the possibility that the Saudis might use their ownership of a large U.S. oil refinery to carry out, an economic warfare play they had actually formally announced, namely trying to destroy our fracking industry. Should we be concerned about the idea that in addition to that play, that there will be other opportunities perhaps for them to have access to and perhaps do mischief with our infrastructure?
Well, absolutely. It's obvious that the Saudis are aware that their one export that they have is oil. That is the lifeblood of their economy. They understand that we are now the swing producer in energy thanks to American technology and fracking. And they have made it a point publicly to state that they stand against our American energy industry. Now, they're trying to sell a portion of Saudi Aramco, something that they nationalized years ago, and now they're going to offer a portion of that back for sale because they need capital. But any investments that they make in our infrastructure should be closely scrutinized because they have an intent and a purpose in preventing America from being the number one producer of energy.
This is ominous, needless to say, if that's the case, and I pray that it will be the subject of, as you're suggesting, close scrutiny. Kevin, let me switch gears and talk about another potential avenue of economic warfare against American interests, if not against our own assets, namely Chinese activity. You've talked about this for some time in the cyber warfare space. What's the latest as we now see it from what they've been doing to this South Korean company, Lotte, as I believe it's pronounced?
Well, you know, this goes to the original point, which is we view the world as an economic marketplace. Our adversaries view it as an economic battle space. And proof of that comes from China got mad because the South Koreans are building this THAAD missile system that's being deployed there, and it's being deployed on a golf course that this company, Lotte, owned that they made available to the government. And all of a sudden, there were Chinese denial of service attacks on their stores. And there were, in China, raids on the stores to determine whether they met all the codes and the regulations and so forth. It was clearly an economic attack and response because a company allowed a golf course to be used for the defense of South Korea in a way that China didn't like. And so this is economic warfare 101. The Chinese have never stopped. They will continue to do it. They understand cyber and they understand economics, and they've used them as weapons.
And in this case, there's reason to believe that it will not be restricted to the South Koreans, I assume. Speaking of Korea, the North Koreans have evidently also been engaging in cyber warfare capabilities, building them and exploiting them. I talked earlier in the program with Claudia Rosette about the latest reports that a UN panel of experts has had their IT systems penetrated by an as yet unidentified cyber hacker. There does seem to be a reason the North Koreans would want to shut them down, as this panel was engaged in apparently pretty good work in terms of monitoring efforts to defeat sanctions on the North Korean regime. Now, as Claudia mentioned, that may mean that the Russians or the Chinese or other people who are engaged in that kind of activity might have an interest in shutting this panel down. But Kevin, based on what you know about what the North Koreans are up to, should we be concerned that this is just further evidence of their tradecraft and increasing aggressiveness?
You know, a few years ago, most of the cyber experts in the United States just discounted the idea that North Korea would have a very sophisticated hacking unit. They were wrong. They were naive. North Korea has Unit 180, which is very sophisticated and has been tied even today. Symantec said that they were likely tied to the Lazarus Group, who was behind the WannaCry ransomware attack, the mother of all hacks. They were likely involved in the Bangladesh theft through the SWIFT system that we've talked about on this program before. North Korea is very sophisticated, and they often leave breadcrumbs that point back to China or to other locations because, frankly, they just don't have great internet connectivity inside North Korea, so they have cells that are placed in other adjacent and neighboring countries that carry out using their weapons. And so they are very sophisticated and they are very dangerous.
Kevin, one of the dangers that is of particular concern is evidence that our own cyber supply chain, as it's been called, is potentially a very serious Achilles heel for us against one or all of these adversaries. There's a task force that's recently reported on those vulnerabilities. Tell us a little bit about it and where you think we're likely to go on the basis of its recommendations.
Yeah, this is a report from the Defense Science Board. It's the Task Force on Cyber Supply Chain. And what it does is it recognizes that the internet is a very complex beast, and anyone who's participating in it uses all sorts of equipment and technology and personnel to obtain and to do what they want to do. Infiltration at any one of those points could put the entire system at risk. And the reality is companies have all kinds of routers and other equipment that come from around the world that if those pieces of equipment are infected or if the IT department itself is under the influence. For example, the worst case would be this group of IT staffers at the House that had access to all of the government secrets and potentially could be blackmailing any number of members of Congress. I think there were five Pakistani IT staffers that have sort of, you know, they were in a big job and paid extremely well, better than any other IT staffers, and now they've just sort of been taken off and disappeared because of the risk there.
But, it certainly is a matter of concern because I think, Kevin Freeman, as you suggest, there's a yawning issue here of what did these guys get access to when they were serving some 20 or perhaps many more House Democrat members who are among them on committees like the Intelligence Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Armed Services Committee. We need to know the extent of the compromise of their IT systems and perhaps whether they're at risk of blackmail or other things. These are questions I know you'll be following, as will we. Unfortunately, Luke Rosiak is at the Daily Caller. We hope to interview him shortly about his latest reports on this very important subject. Kevin Freeman, thank you for yours, all of which can be accessed at globaleconomicwarfare.com. And look for Kevin at the Blaze Network this summer. I hope the rest of you will be looking for us tomorrow, same time, same station, right here. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.